How is multimedia changing the rules for the ways academics research and release their work? Could watching 24 hours of uncut video of some random stranger be the most interesting thing in the world? The answers to these questions and more on this week's Radio Berkman. In academia, the phrase publish or perish is thrown around to describe the pressure professors and researchers are under to produce original research if they want to keep their jobs. These days, an academic is probably more likely to use a video camera and laptop in their research than a pen and paper, but depending on the field you're in, using the tools of digital media might be more or less discouraged. Take sociology, for instance. How many sociologists do you know who not only take video of the people they're studying, but publish that video as their main piece of academic work? Today we talk to one sociologist who is doing just that, sort of. David Evan Harris is the founder of the Global Lives Project. While a trained sociologist and the author of a forthcoming book about domestic workers in Brazil that represents more traditionally defined academic work, David's work with the Global Lives Project represents a blurring of the lines between sociological research and video art. David recently spoke with me about what the Global Lives Project is and how video and online collaborative work might come to be more recognized in academia.
Well, the Global Lives Project started out as an idea to build a video library of human life experience that would be shown in museums or galleries or other public places as a collection of 10 24-hour long pieces of video footage of a day in the life of 10 different people from around the world. So all the video was shot without any interruptions, and we ended up with this wonderful 240 hours of video content of people's lives from the US, Brazil, Malawi, Japan, China, India, Indonesia, Serbia, Lebanon, and Kazakhstan that we produced over the last 5 years. And we just launched the video installation, the very first time we've shown all 10 of these videos at once, at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, a great museum in downtown San Francisco.
I'm interested to hear you talk about why you think this is interesting, why you think watching 24 hours in the life of some stranger is particularly fascinating. But why don't you describe the exhibit first? Describe what the exhibit looks like.
So actually, we've done a couple different iterations of the exhibit, but the basic gist of it is that you walk in and you show up at the museum or the gallery or the public place at 10 a.m. and you step out of your 10 a.m. and you step into the 10 a.m. of the lives of these 10 different people from around the world, and you actually watch the video at the same speed that they're living their lives, no editing, and you really get a glimpse into both the mundanity and the great diversity that is a day in the life of a person in a human body.
And these aren't particularly, by traditional standards, special people. These aren't like heads of state or reality television stars. These are just regular people.
Yeah, actually, the 10 people were selected to be a roughly, and I emphasize roughly, representative sample of the human population in terms of age. We got 6 out of the 10 people under 30 years old, actual religious distribution of the world, the actual geographical distribution of the world. So 60% of the world lives in Asia. So we have 6 people from Asia and 1 from North America, 1 from South America, 1 from Europe, and 1 from Africa. And at the same time, the world just passed 50% urban. So we have 5 urban, 5 rural, 5 men, and 5 women. So that's the idea. And we specifically went out of our way to not have particularly anomalous subjects. And now, you know, they're all visually interesting people, but that doesn't mean they have particularly exciting lives.
And what is interesting about this, if these people's lives aren't particularly exciting, from your perspective, what is interesting about following these people?
Well, it's been really exciting for me to be part of this project. I actually only was part of the crew on 3 out of these 10 shoots, and it was really great to see as the footage came in how different people's lives are around the world, how totally different it is to go through a day in rural Serbia compared to a day in rural Malawi, and then again in the mountains of the island of Java in Indonesia. We're surrounded by really completely different material environments. We have totally different possessions, totally different lifestyles, totally different occupations. But at the same time, through this sort of slow observation of daily life, what also comes out is the way in which we as human beings really confront the same types of challenges, the same types of everyday experiences. You know, having breakfast in one country or another, though you eat different things, there's a certain essence of breakfast that you get to feel as you watch sort of the sleepiness wash away, and the people go through their morning routines, and then people have their first interactions with their family or their friends, get to their workplaces. That sort of cycle of a day is really interesting to watch, and it's, I've seen over and over again now with exhibit visitors, people get really mesmerized and sort of fall out of their own life and fall deeply into these other people's experiences.
Now, you're not an artist by training. Describe your kind of background and how you came to this.
Well, I actually got an undergraduate degree from Berkeley in international development, and it was an interdisciplinary degree, so I actually did take classes in a lot of different departments, and I even sort of dabbled in the art department with a handful of classes at Berkeley. But I ended up going on to get a master's degree in sociology at the University of Sao Paulo. But the thing that I really sensed that was lacking in my sociological work was a certain emotional engagement that I felt every time I experimented with video and put video in front of other people or watched as other people watch documentary or even fiction film, is that the medium of video really has the ability to evoke an emotional reaction in people that, I'm just sorry to say, but long, heavily footnoted academic papers just can't do. But I, and in particular, being an American and having this interest in poverty and in international development, and having myself spent a lot of time in much poorer countries than the U.S., I really wanted to get at that emotionally charged experience of the encounter between people of totally different cultures, totally different backgrounds, and really rich and poor, diverging religions, and see if I could extract from my audiences some of the same emotions that I had when I spent time living with families in other countries. I spent a lot of time as an undergrad living in the families in the homes of families from the Philippines, Mexico, India, Tanzania, and the UK. I did a study abroad program that took me to those places, and that experience really forever changed me. Of even just spending a couple of weeks in a home in another country, it forever changed how I saw that country and how I thought about that country and how I read things about that country. It gave it an individual face, and that's really what I wanted to communicate through Global Lives.
Having spent some time abroad myself, I definitely agree with you. There's a feeling that you have that is almost indescribable when you return home. And I think from having seen the Global Lives Project, the Global Lives Project really captures some of that that story, the story of what it might have been like to spend just a day living in a culture outside of the one that you're used to. But I want to get back to the academic kind of question that you raised. And as you said, the social sciences traditionally has been an area, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that is particularly proud of its rational objective or attempting to be objective approach to a subject. And they might take issue with the idea of video being used, particularly because it has a kind of a greater emotional resonance than text. But you've been kind of pushing for the use of more digital media in social sciences.
I think that social scientists and academics in the humanities need to become fluent in new media, need to develop a literacy in the new media technologies like video, like photography, like audio, and figure out how to manipulate that and use it with the same level of fluency and dexterity that we manipulate text. I've been skating this fine line between sociology and anthropology, and anthropologists actually tend to take issue at the idea of being called a social science. Usually sociologists don't shy away from that moniker. I don't mind if someone wants to call me a social scientist. If you want to get down to it, I'm not a scientist. I'm not in the same way that a physicist or a biologist or a chemist is a scientist. That said, I think that there's a growing body of literature in the social sciences, in sociology. There's this growing subfield of visual sociology. There's a much bigger subfield in anthropology, of visual anthropology. And I think that those fields, combined with also these burgeoning fields of public sociology and public anthropology, really demand a multimedia and, a cross-media approach to scholarship. And it's something that, you started to see in the last couple decades, but increasingly you're seeing social scientists and researchers presenting slideshows at conferences that have photos in them. And occasionally there's a video, in the books that we produce, maybe you get, 15 pages of photos if you're a sociologist or a social scientist that wants to try to slip some photos in there. But they're usually considered sort of peripheral and they add a little flavor. Maybe there's an image on the cover of the book. But I really think that in order to be intellectually honest, we as sociologists and social scientists need to think really hard about the role of the image. I mean, people have been saying for a long time that a picture is worth a thousand words. Then what is video worth? And of course, what is real interaction worth? And if you want to communicate the results of research that involves going to another country or going to a faraway place and talking to someone, what better way is there to present that research than to present the raw video footage of that encounter, of the encounter between researcher and the community that's the subject of the research? And I video presents some problems. How do you footnote in a video, right? Where does the index go in the video? Where are the page numbers? None of these conventions really exist in any clear standardized ways. And then style in a video. Where is the style guide, and what's the proper way to produce an academic piece of new media? Is it always going to include both text with page numbers and references to video? How do you embed the video in there in a way that makes sense and provides for a rich discussion that is sort of in the language of academic thinking, but includes these multimedia pieces?
And that those questions come from sort of an attempt to make video a kind of an analog to the old way of like just basic text and text publishing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot about genres of communication. Since the printing press, many, many genres of text have emerged. You have fiction writing, you have obviously the original religious writings that were published, then you have journalism, and then you have all sorts of other nonfiction genres, then you have more creative approaches to nonfiction writing, and then you have all of the different academic disciplines with their own style, their own journals, their own sets of footnoting guidelines. So there's really a broad proliferation of styles and genres and subgenres of textual communication. Now with video, I think we're only scratching the surface right now. We're at the tip of the iceberg because still, really, to be honest, you can't produce video that easily. You can't really produce good video alone. You need, when you want to produce something that has the same production values, the same level of quality as the kind of video that we're used to seeing on TV, You know, you really need someone who's really good at sound to figure out the sound. You need someone who's really good at holding the camera to, you know, the big word is cinematography, but really you need someone who can just hold the thing steady and think about all the buttons on the camera while someone else, maybe the interviewer, if we're thinking in an academic setting, while the interviewer is thinking about what they're going to say. And when it comes down to it, it's actually kind of hard to do a good interview while holding a camera. I mean, you're multitasking, and a good camera then is going to have 60 or 70 different buttons on it, a whole set of menus. And then beyond that, you want to think a little bit about lighting. And, you know, as you develop your literacy, your ability to communicate and produce video, rather, as I've developed that for myself, I've started to realize that it's not something I want to do alone. You know, in academia, there's this very atomistic tendency for academics to really be producing stuff by themselves. With video, I don't want to produce anything all by myself because I know it will not be the best thing that I can produce. And if you sort of take that atomistic attitude of academic writing and the production of academic texts, and you apply that to video, I think you end up not producing the greatest stuff. And it might take you 5 or 10 years to produce something that if you'd had a team of 5 people, you could have gotten out in, you know, a step of the time.
Right, and it forces you to be become an expert in a field that might, you know, that requires years to learn.
Absolutely.
And it, while you're learning how to do that, you're distracting yourself from the subject that you really are trying to learn, actually.
Absolutely.
And so there's that aspect of it. There's the production aspect of it, the behind the camera aspect to it, and there's another aspect to it. I think particularly when you're doing ethnography, perhaps, that raises questions about the presence of the camera and the presence of digital media in your research. So you're following around a person for 24 hours. There's an aspect to it of that, of where you're actually seeing what's going on in their day, but there might also be an aspect to it that what is the presence of the camera? How is that affecting them and what they do with their day? There's an aspect to it of the viewer on the other end too. If the viewer is watching it, are they assuming that this is their day, or are they taking it with a grain of salt because they know that the subject on screen is aware of the camera?
Yeah, I mean, that is a real problem, and it's a problem though that doesn't just apply to video. I mean, there are all kinds of long texts in anthropology and in the social sciences in general and in psychology. About what is the impact of the interviewer, and you know, what is someone going to say to an interviewer as opposed to what they're going to say to one of their family members or their friends. And you know, the presence of the observer, independent of whether they're carrying a pencil or a camera crew with them, is obviously going to have an impact. And that's why in Global Lives, when we started this project very early on, we had a big sort of internal debate about what we call these people that are allowing us as producers and directors to videotape their lives for 24 hours. And you know, during the very first shoot that we did here in San Francisco, it was with a cable car driver, James, and we told James not to talk to us, and we told him to do his best to pretend that we weren't there while we were videotaping him. And, you know, it became pretty obvious during the course of that day where we were taping him that it was getting a little bit awkward, and he was getting a little bit sick of being recorded. And a lot of people were asking him, you know, what's this camera crew doing following you? And he would explain it. And, you know, the crew was just 2 people, but in any case, it was obviously an interference in his life. So, you know, we decided to push away from that fly on the wall approach in some of the shoots after that, just because we realized that, you know, the crew is obviously having a huge impact on the person's day. You know, and in any attempt to deny that, it would be silly. So what we did, you know, I was part of the second shoot, which we did in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And I told the crew members, and we had kind of a creative discussion, and I said to them that I thought that maybe a better thing to do would be to actually let Hyel, the person we were videotaping, just interact with the camera operators. If the camera operator even had a question, what's going on here? Where are we going? What are you doing right now? Go ahead and ask. Some of the other teams took the fly on the wall approach, and those are just some of the issues that came up around your question. The thing I wanted to mention last is just that we, instead of calling the people that we tape the subjects, sometimes we call them the on-screen participants. And that's a way of emphasizing that they actually are not just the sort of passive subjects, the people being studied, in our research, in our production, in our art, but they're actually participants, and they're the most important participants in the Global Lives Project, in the sense that they are really giving, not just to us, but to the world. All this is under Creative Commons licenses. They're giving to the world 24 hours of their life and their image, and their soul is right there.
Right. Yeah. And I want to provoke you a little bit on that tangent. Have you gotten any pushback on the the social science front, the anthropology front, from the idea of a person who is being studied for all intents and purposes engaging in the study itself? Is there any kind of precedent for that?
I think most social scientists, well, I should say many social scientists, especially qualitative researchers, people in anthropology and sort of the qualitative side of sociological research, have given up on this idea of objectivity as their goal in what they're producing. You know, for me, it was just logical that anything I produce comes from a certain perspective, comes from a certain point of view, and brings to bear all the experiences that I've had over the course of my life.
Well, let's talk about the collaborative nature of this project, because you've really pulled together an impressive group to pull this off. Could this have been possible 10 or 12 years ago, before the internet really took off as a kind of major global phenomenon?
The answer to your question is absolutely no. This would have been completely impossible 10 or 12 years ago. Even 5 years ago, when we started this, YouTube didn't exist, and online video was a thing of the past. And when we tried to just edit the first shoot that we did, we couldn't even afford a hard drive that could fit 24 hours of footage on it. And so we had to come up with sort of creative ways of building the short, the 5 to 10 minute short video that all our directors and producers make of each of the shoots. So, over the course of the last 5 years, it's been a real, real revolution in video production, and especially online video distribution. So the translation and the subtitling of all of these hours and hours of video is actually happening with a tool called .sub. And .sub actually allows you to do today what in your web browser, what you would have just 5 years ago, needed a software package and a very good computer to actually do, which is just subtitling. So now YouTube actually has that captioning feature and even some automatic translation tools, which don't work very well yet, but I think it's around the corner. But for example, if you want to watch our video that's Welcome to the Global Lives Project that explains what we're doing, which I'd encourage you to watch, it's on our front page at globallives.org. You can actually watch that in 13 different languages, subtitled. Yeah, it's hard for me to imagine us even coming close to doing what we've done on a pretty minuscule budget 5 years ago, even. I think it would have just been impossible. I would have given up. If I'd started this project 10 years ago, I would have given up very early on.
Do you think it would have been as interesting of a project if... weren't for the kind of changes the world has seen in the last few years, the kind of greater connectivity? Like right now, I can go to your exhibit and see what it's like to be a young child in Kazakhstan. But now I can do that, but I can then go home and look it up on Wikipedia, look up what, the kind of like current topics in Kazakhstan are. I can make a pen pal in Kazakhstan. I can IM with somebody in Kazakhstan, without having to think too much about it. Would this have been as interesting, pre-internet? Would it have been as interesting before the world was as interconnected as it is now?
Yeah, I think absolutely not. I think that one of the really exciting things about this project is it's not my project. You know, I'm an American guy, and I've got a college education, and I'm sitting here in California. I grew up in the Silicon Valley, and I've got access to all these great technologies and access to the resources that being at a great American university offers you. But I didn't do this alone. I didn't fly around the world. Actually, to produce this video footage shot in 10 different countries, we never paid for a single plane ticket for anyone. And I think that's what makes this really exciting, is that it's a network of collaborators of dozens of different nationalities who came together to produce this footage as volunteers, to transmit the footage to each other over the internet and on hard drives that have been, FedExed and mailed and shipped by every means you can imagine around the world. And I think the fact that we were able to do this production, I mean, you could even call it a virtual video production infrastructure that we created. We have no office. We've just got a collection of hard drives that's sitting in front of me in my living room right now. And that's kind of the only asset we have, other than some projectors and some screens to show the footage on that are sitting in a museum right now. It makes it much more interesting. And it also makes us, I think, scalable in a very exciting way. And I don't think I've mentioned yet that we're in the planning stages right now of doing dozens more shoots, producing video in many other different countries, and also using our existing network of collaborators, the people who produced and directed and shot these first 10 videos. They're all getting ready to do exhibitions and screenings and showings in different formats with different architects, different designers, different numbers of screens, in different languages in their own home countries. The footage is being translated online. We're putting all the footage, the full high definition content, on the Internet Archive so that anyone can just download it and show it in any format they want to.
And this is all to further the goal of creating an online encyclopedia of human experience. Did I recite that properly?
Yeah, well, we say a video library of human life experience. I mean, you could call it an encyclopedia, but that would be, I think, a little bit less accurate than a library. And I think that the library metaphor, is very apt, even though we do find ourselves having our library installed at the moment in an art museum. I think of our exhibits as almost like a bookmobile or like a public reading where you have, an author come to read their work and you try to get the public there. But at the core, this is a library of footage that captures the essence of human experience, 24 hours, a full day of human life, in these people from totally disparate backgrounds around the world. And in the same way that a library tries to grow their collection, tries to develop diversity of topics, of volumes, we're also trying to diversify and collect an increasingly interesting, accessible, and sustainable collection that will be around for as long as people have screens to watch video on.
So where can people find out more about the Globalized Project and the current exhibition?
You can watch all of our 240 hours of video footage and the life stories of all of our 10 participants at globallives.org, our website. And you can come see our exhibit in 4 months at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco.
David Harris, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dan. It's been a pleasure.
David Evan Harris is the founder of the Global Lives Project, which is on display at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco through June 20th. Full disclosure, I'm happy to say that I was one of the 600 or so volunteers who brought this project to life. I followed around a cable car driver in San Francisco with a camera for 18 straight hours myself. If you'd like to help out too, or just find out more about the project, visit www.globallives.org. You can find more links to David's work, or leave a comment about this show on our website, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.